Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So, you want to be a farmer. You dream of your own little place, sweet corn, veggies, chickens in the barnyard, rustic heaven. Ask Kurt Timmermeister about it. He slid almost accidentally into becoming a small farmer. Believe him, it's not Green Acres, but he's found a way to make it work. This hour on Point, one man's long learning curve to make a living on the farm. Joining me now from Seattle is Kurt Timmermeister, owner of Kurtwood Farms in Vashon, Washington. It's an island off Seattle. It's now a 13-acre dairy farm. His specialty is artisanal cheese, but he's tried almost everything over the years. Beekeeping, sheep, vegetables, pigs, cider, goats. He writes about it all in his terrific book, Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land. Kurt Timmermeister, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, great to chat with you, Tom.
Paint a picture of your place as it stands now. We're going to go back and look at how all this unfolded. It's quite a story, really a terrific story, and a lot of learning. I'm sure learning for our listeners on that learning curve, too. But just most people don't know what Vashon is, the island. Where does it sit from Seattle? And what's your 13-acre place look like, produced today, Kurt?
Vashon Island is an island just off of Seattle. It's reached by a ferry boat. A pretty quick ride, just 20 minutes at the most, maybe 15 minutes.
Okay, nearby.
And a complete world away from Seattle. It's very, very underpopulated and pretty rural.
Okay, we get there, 15, 20 minutes from the city of Seattle. We hop off, we get to your farm. What's it look like? What do we see? Is this hilly, flat? What are you growing? What's it?
It's not traditional, like, Midwest farmland by any means. It's very hilly. It's pretty rocky. Not really great soil, but it's filled with life today. There's probably 15 cows. We just had one born a couple of days ago, so we're probably up to 16 if I counted them all.
Congratulations.
Lots of stuff going on, lots of vegetables grown and so on. Most of it's about cheese today, though, but it's a very lush place today.
And this is not something that just popped up overnight. You've spent how many years kind of wading gradually into your life of farming, Kurt?
I moved there originally 21 years ago, which is hard to believe. It certainly was a long slog, but one that I've enjoyed through it, and it's been great fun for sure. But it's been a long time coming.
21 years. You didn't start out as a farmer. I mean, you say you didn't intend to become a farmer. You wanted to get you were kind of a city kid. You had successful cafe and restaurants in Seattle. You wanted to get away.
Absolutely. I used it. It's where I lived, and I commuted to the city to work to run my restaurants in Seattle. And I was really looking for some better food, and it certainly came into my lap accidentally. Little by little, I would grow one thing and then another, and sometimes find success, many times find failure, but enough success to keep me going and keep me excited about it.
I want to talk about those experiences. I think many people dream about doing something like that. You must find it yourself when you're out and about. People look at you. You've got a farm now, and you're producing your own stuff, and you're selling your terrific cheese. I've got some here on the table in front of me. We're going to taste it. They must look at you and say, wow, you're living the dream, man.
At this point, it looks a little dreamlike. I think I didn't hear that, 10, 15, 18 years ago by any stretch. People would actually look at it at that kind of time period and wonder what on earth I was thinking.
You know, when I first picked this up, I wondered the same thing, because it is not something easy, and to learn it all, I mean, it's terrific to read you sort of picking up skills and insights one by one. I grew up on a family farm in the Midwest, seventh generation farm now, so it's been in the family for such a long time. And when I think back, to all those years as a kid farming, I can't imagine how one accumulates the knowledge. I mean, when I was there, there were always three generations of people around and all of their insight and handed down wisdom over, you know, since 1818 and everything that had already been done with the land to prepare it and all the tools. I mean, there are 100-year-old tools people were still using and knew how to use. How do you begin to accumulate all of that sort of finger feel for the land and simple information about how to do it, Kurt?
It certainly is a challenge, without question. I would almost say that it might be easier to have no preconceived idea of it, and so you can look at it completely fresh, and I could go into it with a different point of view, and also not knowing how difficult it was and what the chance of failure was. Ignorance is really quite convenient in that way. The people I meet who grew up on family farms rarely still want to do it. They've seen the difficulty of it, and they don't want to keep going. I was too stupid to know that it was going to be difficult, so I just kept plodding along until I found it some success.
You know, I still love the farm. I'm back there every chance I get. It's a fantastic environment. It was a fantastic childhood. And I, like a lot of people, sort of dream of doing it on the side sometime, but I know how much work it is to do something like that on the side. What's your routine today, Kurt, on the farm? How much cheese do you produce? What's it take to make it happen?
I produce probably in the range of 300, 350 pieces you have sitting on your desk there, I believe.
Yeah, it looks like a little Camembert
style cheese. Mm-hmm. They're 8 ounces each. So they're like a little round, you know, French-style Camembert cheese. We make right around 300 a week. The cows are milked 7 days a week, twice a day.
Is that you or somebody else doing that,
milking,
my friend?
I probably milk 10 of the 14 milkings a week. And I actually don't get up as early as people think I do. I usually start milking at 7 or so. Mm-hmm. And just start making cheese about 8:30 or so, and it goes most of the day. And it's more that it's a consistent. It's 7 days a week for sure. It's very hard to get a day off. But it's a lovely lifestyle without question. There's a calmness to it and a predictability to it. But it's not. It's not like work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and then you have the weekend with nothing going on. Nothing like that at all.
I was surprised in a way.
It's a continual process.
Yeah. The fact that you ended up in dairy kind of surprised me. I mean, we had, you know, all the field crops and cattle and hogs and sheep and chickens and all the rest between all the extended family farm there. But dairy was always considered the one that took the most commitment because it was every day and every day and every day and early in that day. And yet that's where you've ended up. I wonder why.
I wish you had told me that like 7 years ago. It would have saved me some time and given me some vacations, I think. The other side to it is, yes, it takes way more time. It's very hard to get time off. But on the scale of farms that I'm talking about, like mine is 13 acres, which is kind of, you know, that kind of middle range of the middle-sized farm, I couldn't possibly make a living in any way if I grew soybeans or corn or hogs or something. So if you have this kind of scale, you have to have something that's a value-added product. It has to be rather expensive, rather unique, and so on. And it's a fairly short list of products that can fall into that category. And for me, it was a farmstead artisanal cheese, and that's why I did it. I would probably much rather, you know, plant corn or something, but I don't have the land for it. I don't have the volume of land, nor the quality of the land, nor, you know, It's not flat even.
You waded into it. You didn't jump whole hog. I mean, in fact,
no.
there were many years where you were still running the cafe or restaurant back in Seattle and doing the farming on the side. And as I read you, that turned out to be kind of important. It sounds as though you might have capsized in a hurry if it had been all one big push to try and make a living off the farm. I mean, in terms of taking away illusions about what this takes, you brought a second income to it. You brought resources from that other career to it that helped make it possible.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one thing is, in working in a restaurant or owning a restaurant for almost 20 years, that also is a very busy job. It goes nonstop. The restaurant I own was open from 7 to midnight, 7 days a week. We would often be open on Christmas Day. Farming is almost like a little calmer, a little less hours per week. But I'm very clear in the book about the finances of a small farm, and the reason that I have a farm today, the reason that I can do it, is without question because I'm not 25, I'm nearly 50, and I had a first career that was profitable for me. What got the farm going was the proceeds from the restaurant, without question. And it was certainly necessary. It was imperative that it worked out that way.
And for a long time, you really actually blended the two. You worked on the farm, brought in your crop, and used that crop to actually cook meals for people in your cookhouse. Kurt's Place, right, at Kurtwood Farms. Every Sunday night, they'd come out, slap down their money to eat it fresh off the farm right there. That was important income for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and also, it was great fun, and it was important to me to spend time with people, talk to them about food, talk to them about where their food came from. And that probably is what I think the book is mostly about, is getting people to reconnect to their food. This tremendous disconnect we have across the country where people really don't know where their food comes from or where food in general comes from. They don't really know what a pig looks like, what a cow looks like, really simple things. And that's very much what I wanted to accomplish, both in doing the dinners and in writing the book.
But there's this whole push, and you know it well, the locavore food, people who want to know where it's come from, people who get out
Absolutely.
To the farmer's market. The next thing you know, you must have heard this, they're dreaming about, growing it themselves.
And I certainly welcome it. I mean, my hope is that everyone with a backyard and so on, it'd be a little harder if you had an apartment or a condo or something, but at least has a couple of chickens, at least grow some vegetables, maybe a couple of fruit trees. You're probably not going to sustain yourself in your backyard in Seattle or Boston or, Chicago or somewhere, but I think you get a much better sense of food. You'll have some incredibly high-quality food that you did yourself, that you were a part of. And you'll have this great connection. And I hugely welcome that. I don't know that I would suggest to too many people that they should, quit their job in the city and suddenly start a farm. It would be incredibly difficult.
Kurt, we've got callers with questions for you right off the bat. And let's just
Excellent.
Bring them on in. Jake in Boston, you're on the air with Kurt in Seattle. Jake, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a 26-year-old kid in Boston, and I did 6 years of architecture school in rural western Massachusetts, where I was very well acquainted with local farmers. I was involved in CSAs out there. And
CSAs, where people buy a share of the produce from a farm? Yeah.
Yes, a crop share. Got quite familiar with all of the farmers out there and was introduced to permaculture. Took permaculture design courses and really just such a love for producing food. Now I have community garden plots in this area, and I was able to grow about 500 pounds of food last year. I'm going to try and double that this year. And my dream is to be a farmer. I want to be a farmer so badly. I think about it every waking minute, but I can't do it. I have student loan debt up the wazoo, and it's holding me back. I can't leave my job. Nothing. I'm really stuck where I am. I live a pretty good life. I can't complain. I have the support of all of my family and friends, and I have a great girlfriend who supports me, and everybody wants me to make this move and move forward towards farming, but I just can't make it happen. I'm really at a loss, and I can't find any good advice from anybody. I was wondering if your guest had any advice for me.
We'll pick it up, Jake. And don't feel alone. I mean, I've known plenty of, second and third sons, daughters, and farm families that don't know how to put a farm together. It's never been easy to do. But what do you say, Kurt, to Jake? There he is, longing to be it. Do it.
It's a common question, and I get it fairly regularly, and it's a very difficult one, and it's a very common one. When I'm being a little flip, I would say, go be an architect, go be a banker for 20 years, and then go back to it. I mean, that's kind of the easiest way to do it. It's a very long one, but that is kind of the best way to do it. What is frustrating is you have this incredible passion, and I would hate to quell that. I mean, that's it's fabulous, and you don't see that in that many professions, that someone is that excited to do a job, and especially a job that's difficult. There is the financial realities of it. Land is very expensive, and food just really isn't that profitable. That's the great downside. you know, join an existing farm, you know, one that's going, you know, so that you can be a part of it, but it's not a financial part of it or something. I think we have this kind of strange romanticism that someone could have a farm and be profitable. And I think, you know, since the beginning of the Republic, everyone also had an outside income in many, many ways. And I think that the idea that you know, you could have a farm and be profitable quickly and easily, I'm not really sure where we got it from. I had the same idea, and I think it's rather false. But I think the outside income, you know, hopefully your girlfriend is a, you know, a banker in Boston or something, and then she can help, you know, keep the farm going. I think that's a viable alternative and so on. But I think it's tough for everyone. And until we can, you know, really raise the price of food and differentiate between the food that you would grow on a small farm and large industrial farm, and then you could price it accordingly. I think that's what we need to do on a national level to really change this.
Jake, let us keep working it here. Thanks for your call. Let me get one more, and we'll look to your experience, Kurt. But Margaret in Charleston, South Carolina, thank you for calling, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm calling because this show is really speaking to me. My boyfriend and I currently rent an eighth of an acre in urban Charleston, South Carolina, and have converted the whole backyard into a vegetable farm. It's not for sale or anything. It's all for us, but we're actually putting in chickens next week as well.
What are you growing, Margaret? What's on your 1/8 of an acre there? What are you growing?
Oh. What isn't? We have 6 types of tomatoes, 6 types of pepper, all kinds of leafy greens, strawberries, blueberries, corn, beans, squash, peas, cucumbers.
And chickens coming in next week. And what's your dream? What's your goal, Margaret? Or have you got it already?
All right. Well, this is the practice for the goal. The goal, we're currently both saving about half of each paycheck for this goal. It is to purchase a farm somewhere, hopefully in North Carolina, and just sort of be self-sufficient and work when we have to.
I love it.
But your main income off the farm, work on the side to cover it. How long do you think that's going to take, Margaret, to get there?
I don't know. I don't actually have a problem with having a good part-time job as long as I can kind of do my own farm thing the rest of the time.
It sounds lovely. What do you say, Kurt?
I love the excitement of it. I mean, the eighth of an acre near the city, I think, is brilliant. And I think that's a great option for most people in the country who really want to have some great vegetables and some great eggs from their chickens and so on. Growing it bigger is going to have some great challenges. You sound like an amazing, resourceful woman, and will do just fine at it. But I love the eighth of an acre. I like that. I think that's fabulous. And you'll have amazing vegetables.
Margaret, I appreciate your call. We've got a lot more I want to get to, but march us through some of your learning here. Let's start with vegetables, if we can, Kurt. I mean, you tell a really interesting story about how you first, it was your first thought, let's go to vegetables. Right. I mean, actually, honeybees in there, too. We'll look at that. But when you came to veggies, it's okay. Fine. We know what to do here. We'll have a CSA. We'll have people sort of buy into a weekly delivery from your little place there on Vashon Island, and you'll sell at the farmer's market. Everything will be fantastic. Let's go. Let's do it. How'd that all work?
It was not as successful as I had planned. I don't have particularly good soil. Vashon Island doesn't have any particularly good soil. It's not river bottom at all. It's an island, a glacial island. So that was the first problem. And then we got down to the nuts and bolts of the finances of it, and it was tremendously difficult. It just never really added up, and it was shocking because I had owned, you know, restaurants beforehand. I had a good sense of a small business, and it just kind of gave me this odd feeling as we got through the season. I was like, you know, it's just not enough. This is crazy. I've been working all day long. I have people working for me, and it's manual labor. It's weeding carrots and so on, and it's not covering the bills.
If I recall correctly, you grossed $17,500. Your expenses were more than $10,000, and that's for you and another and another, and oh my goodness.
Yeah, We weren't even close. I mean, it wasn't even like, well, you know, maybe if I got a little busier next year, I can pull this off. I wasn't even in the ballpark. And I certainly know farmers, you know, on Vashon who do better than they're more qualified at it. They've been doing it a little longer, and they come close. When you start adding up like the price of, you know, your health insurance or something, it's like trying to cover an expense like that is tremendous. That's a lot of vegetables.
And just putting out the folding table at the farmer's market and that interaction and the whole dynamic of who got there and who sold for what. Give us a taste of that.
Gosh, I've been talking about this maybe a little too much. It's a funny thing where I think people really want to believe that farmers markets are these beautiful clubs of like-minded friends who get together and have a great time selling. I had some of those experiences.
Yeah.
I had some that weren't quite the same. They're business, and people are out to promote their business for sure. And sometimes there are conflicts with that. I mean, people want to have the best spot. They've been having the same spot every year. They want to price it at their price, and so on. And they're very regulated little operations about what you can bring, when you can bring it, what stall you have, what time you have to start, what time you have to finish, and so on. It's not all free love. It's a little more complicated than that. I like talking to people, so that part is really fun. But if you're standing there for, you know, 6 hours and you don't have what people want, if you've got a table full of kale and they've come looking for tomatoes, even if it's, you know, April, it's a very kind of disheartening 6 hours of standing there trying to get people
please,
to buy some kale from
buy
you.
Buy my kale. And then you had your
please.
CSA. You'd promised people these weekly deliveries. It sounded so great, but there were weeks where there was just really nothing to deliver there.
One thing we kind of need a cultural shift in this country where we're for the last 50 years we're used to walking into the big stores and there's everything there every single day, no matter if it's snowing. I mean, there could be 3 feet of snow in Boston and you can still go in and get a beautiful head of lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
I can't grow a beautiful head of lettuce in December. It's really very difficult. And so people have expectations of what, you know, a box would look like. And certainly anyone can grow a great box in, you know, June, July, August, and into September. So April, May is a very challenging, you know, time. So dropping off a box of, you know, kale and maybe some, you know, spring onions and people just kind of look at you and they're like, I wrote you a check for $500 and I've got three bunches of kale and, you know, and some spring onions. And you're like, what? You're going to have tomatoes in 3 months. That's something to look forward to.
Hang on. Be happy. Go with nature. You worked with bees. That wasn't exactly a success. Fruit, apples, vinegar, sheep. Now, this is in my bailiwick. You know, we had cattle and hogs and chickens and all that around. But sheep were mine. And it was really interesting to listen, to read. You describe sort of, you know, getting your first ones and the sort of beauty and difficulty and lambing and all the rest. What was that like, taking it on fresh?
It was completely accidental. I was actually looking for pigs. I couldn't find pigs. As you were talking about, you know, your six generations, I had no generation, so I didn't even know where to buy a pig. That took some time. But in the meantime of searching for these baby pigs, someone on the island said, I have these two sheep. I don't want them anymore. Will you take them? And I was like, sure. I got these. I put the fence up. I got that. And miraculously, through no work of my own, I had baby lambs a few weeks later. Raised them up, and then I slaughtered them, and it was one of those kind of aha eureka moments of this is the most beautifully tasting thing I have ever had in my life. We roasted it on a spit with some rosemary and so on, and it was extraordinary. And that really said that I have got to grow some better food and eat some really great food. And that much did it. Saying that, I don't have sheep anymore. I had them for many years, and now I've given all the pasture to the cows. For that moment of fabulousness when you're outside with your friends around the spit eating this beautiful, beautiful leg of lamb, there's 364 days where you're like, oh my gosh, those damn sheep are out there and I don't know what to do with them. And they have worms maybe, or they need to be sheared or something, or they've gotten out, they've gotten into the neighbor's yard and so on.
Or they've got mastitis, you're dealing with that, or like cows, they can get the bloat and you've got to deal with that.
Yep.
You end up with Jersey cows, and then these are not the big Holsteins everybody sees all the time in the big dairy farms. They're smaller, they've got a higher
high butterfat
in that milk.
Right.
Therefore, to make this delicious cheese, I've got some right here in front of me. This is Dinah's cheese. Dinah was your first cow, as I recall.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
This is a gorgeous little round here. You're milking them not by hand every day. You've got your machine out there. You pop it
right.
on
it's,
and vacuum goes.
If you know dairies,
delicious
it's
cheese,
not
by
a
the way.
Really line system.
Tart.
I'm sure it's hopefully very tasty.
Very tasty.
It is the modern miracle that I can. It left the farm at 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon outside of Seattle, and it's in your studio.
That's not organic travel, but it sure is.
No, it's got a bit of a footprint, but it's worth it. It's worth it once in a while.
That is delicious. So what's your interaction with these now? You're sort of herding them in one at a time, then they'll come into the stall, I guess, and
they come into the milking parlor and they're milked. It's a small mechanical system. It's run by a vacuum pump, and they're called a bucket milker. So it's a sealed can, and the milk goes right into it. And then I physically take that can and take it into the milk room and pour it into the bulk tank.
What's it take to turn it into this beautiful little round of Camembert here?
It's a fussy process, but one that I think I've mastered this point after a couple of years. It spends a day in the make room, in where the cheese is made, in the vat. It's a pasteurized cheese, so it's pasteurized first, then a culture is introduced, the molds are introduced, and then it's coagulated, cut, and it's molded. And after 25 days, it'll have that beautiful, beautiful snowy white mold on the outside. Mm-hmm. They're wrapped and aged, and they'll get super, super gooey. Because they're Jersey cows, they make this beautiful, rich milk, and it looks like butter. It'll turn really golden, especially in the summer. It makes an extraordinary cheese. The cows are very healthy. They're very happy. And they make great
delicious.
Milk.
And off it goes. And at this point, with a lot of things paid off already, it's paying the bills. Mark in Cornwall, Vermont, you're on the air with Kurt Timmermeister in Seattle. Thanks for calling, Mark.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your story?
I just want to thank you for putting this topic on air. I'm 29. I took my first apprenticeship on a farm about 11 years ago. Started my own business about 5 years ago, and my wife and I finally purchased our own farm about 2 years ago. But
wow.
I still need continual inspiration from first-generation farmers that are making a go of it and, you know, making it work, you know, to keep me going every day.
Congratulations to you for getting that far along. How many acres? What are you raising, Mark?
We bought 120 acres here, and we raise cattle, hogs, veal calves, chickens. And I also owe my start to the CSA farmers in Western Massachusetts, where I worked out a creative arrangement on a vegetable farm to start raising my own animals and sell them through his market.
That's fantastic. And what do you love? What drives you crazy at this point, Mark?
Well, it's just, I enjoy being outside and working with the animals. There is a calm, a calm sense to it every day, and it's steady and it's continual, and I get to be my own boss, and it's always great to be able to provide food to people who really enjoy it and get excited about it, and, that keeps me going.
And when that next 18-year-old comes along looking to apprentice on your farm, are you encouraging them? It's a good thing to do? Try it? Or good heavens, be careful.
Definitely. We had even last year, we had a high school kid come by, and he was trying to play around with the idea of it. And, he came by a couple days a week and just to check it on. And he went to Cornell to study ag, and he's excited about it. So, that's how I started, on first generation farms through the apprenticeship. And I would like to, foster that as well. So,
Mark, I'm really glad for your call. Thank you so much. Kurt, here they are, the next generation marching in behind you, stepping up.
I think
to
it's
try
fabulous.
And do it.
It's amazing. As much as I do say, it's definitely a challenge to put together a farm in a first-generation sense like that. It is possible. I'm sitting here talking about it. Your caller, the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it certainly weeds people out. If you have a tremendous passion and you really want to do this and you have to do it, I think people can pull it off without question.
Lots of feedback online here. Kurt, here's a Vermont dairy farmer, says, we have to love what we do because it's 14-hour days, being on call 24 hours a day, every day of the year, little or no return other than to love what you do. Gustavo's listening. He's got a little urban place here. He says, trying to keep the squirrels off my tomatoes tells me anything more than my balcony container gardening is a lot of work. And here's another current farmer says, please, if you're going to encourage people to farm, insist they get a real education somehow if animals are involved. Too many animals suffer at the hands of inexperienced and starry-eyed novices from too much care as well as too little. It's not like it's not like having a pet kitten, Kurt.
I would agree with that one, absolutely. And I've been guilty of some of that. You find that education very quickly. It's one thing to have your tomato plant be eaten by squirrels. To do harm to an animal is just the most excruciating thing. And with luck, you never make a mistake twice on that one. But I completely agree. People need to know what they're doing, for sure.
Let's get Don here from Shopville, Kentucky on. Hi, Don. Thanks for calling. You're on with Kurt Timmermeister.
Hey, man. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I, just this year, actually, this past year, we bought some land. And looking forward to getting into farming. But I heard the caller from Boston, that the young guy who wanted to get into it, said he couldn't afford it because of student loans. I know exactly where he's coming from. And the only thing I can figure is that I just got to do this in stages, you know. We made the purchase of the land, like I said, this year. It's going to be at least 4 years before we're living on the land. And then I would say another five before we're putting into place the
land. Don, is it a going concern now, a going farm that you've bought these 100 acres or not, Don?
All right. Well, like I told your screener, right now we're farming rocks and trees, so we're completely starting from scratch, you know. But that's, for me, that was the best way to get into it because I could get the land at, you know, at such a good price. But I'm looking forward to it, and I appreciate the show, man. It gives you some, you know, inspiration to hear this guy who's actually done it.
100 acres, rocks and trees, and a whole lot of work, and we hope joy to come. Thank you, Don. Kurt, there's a hill to climb.
I think that's how we have to look at it. I mean, I certainly, you know, had rocks and trees and so on with my land, and it looked like nothing 21 years ago, and it produced nothing for years. I did live on it from the first day, but in this incredible little shack. I think if we look at it, I went to a great lecture years and years ago that still has stuck with me, which was the idea that there's a 50-year plan. That's the kind of time frame we need to look at, not three. I mean, we usually look at a business as, you know, you start it and it, you know, should make a profit in 2 years or something. That's really not what a farm could ever possibly do. But if you look at it as 50, like, you know, he's bought the 100 acres. In 5 years, you know, he can maybe build some kind of structure so he can spend, you know, some time there, maybe plant some fruit trees and so on, and move on to it full time in 10 or 15 or something. I think that's perfectly legitimate and fabulous. And that works best. The worst possible thing someone could do would be to take out a loan, a large loan, not just a mortgage, but like, oh, I'm going to borrow a bunch of money and buy a tractor and put up a barn and build a house and so on. That would be a recipe for failure without question. But I think the little by little by little. The most inspiring person, the lecture that I heard was a man named Henning, who lives up in San Juan Islands. And he only paid cash. He paid cash for a small piece of land. He never lived on it. He actually taught at the University of Washington. Then he built a little bit. He went up there on the weekends. He started and so on and so on. He never took any debt on. And now he has a beautiful, successful farm in the San Juans. I think that is probably the most likely one. The conventional kind of business model of you go to a bank and you borrow this money and you start your business and you get a return in a year is folly.
Be ready to take that long, slow path. Kurt Timmermeister, stand by if you'd be good enough in Seattle. I'm happy to have joining us right now Rebecca Gould from the studios of Middlebury College in Vermont, Associate Professor of Religion and Environmental Studies at Middlebury College. She's author of At Home in Nature, Modern Homesteading and Spiritual Practice in America. Rebecca Gould, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
We are hearing a lot these days of interest, kind of hunger, appetite to get out there, not just for the farmers market produce and the kind of locavore food and appetites, but people who want to get out and get their hands in the dirt. I know it's not the first time in American history this has happened, but do you see this? Do you see a generation, for whatever reason, wanting to get closer to actually making the food, Rebecca?
Yeah, it's very interesting because if you think as a historian, then you realize that this has been going on for a very long time, really since Thoreau went back to Walden, even though he wasn't a homesteader by classic definition. But this desire to get back to the land and out of whatever's going on in the mainstream culture, that's been going on for a very long time. At the same time, it's new each time it happens. And mm-hmm. I think that the kinds of things that Kurt has been talking about so beautifully in his book do express the concerns in our culture now that weren't the same as what there were in an earlier periods.
I mean, you wrote your book on sort of modern homesteading just 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago. What do you see changing, even in these last half dozen years, Rebecca?
You know, it's really interesting because I now want to write my book all over again. There's certain things that weren't there explicitly with the homesteaders I interviewed that are there now. The language of doing things in a carbon neutral way. The homesteaders I interviewed were certainly doing that, but they didn't understand that that's what they were doing. They wouldn't promote it as a carbon neutral way of living. Similarly, locavore, that became, I think if I'm remembering correctly, the word of the year in the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, in 2007. Mm-hmm. So that also wasn't out there when I was doing my research. And it's fascinating and also very uplifting for me to see a whole new wave that expresses these new interests and at the same time taps into the kind of spiritual and psychological longing to be on the land that you heard from a lot of the callers. So that's, you know, has a connection in history for a long time, but it's being expressed in different ways now. And I think partly because of our speeded up culture and more kind of urban living, as commercial as our culture becomes, there is, again, the more desire to be back to the land and to eat local food as part of that.
Well, I wonder if you see it as more the appetite for local food or something spiritual, or is the carbon footprint concern now a kind of spirituality in itself? It's sort of existential.
Yes, I completely agree with you, Tom, on that, because I would say when you start looking at the hunger people have, literal and spiritual and psychological, for local food, and you look at the interest in carbon neutral living, for instance, I just heard the other day about a whole movement in Protestantism and in the Catholic Church of being carbon neutral for Lent. And I think this all describes, and some people might chuckle, but I think it all describes a desire to kind of get in touch with the existential questions of our time, as you were saying, a desire to get back to the land, a desire not to have a negative impact on our planet. I would still say this is not a majority kind of way of living in our culture for sure, but the fact that it's growing now, the fact that so many people, say, in New York City or in Philadelphia are raising bees on the roofs of their apartments and getting chickens, this kind of thing was not happening when I was doing my research. So what I see here is that the urge that's behind homesteading, which is at least partially spiritual, is now almost more mainstream.
Kurt, how much of your inspiration to get out there on first your little 4-acre plot, now you're 13 acres, I mean, can you put a ratio on it? Is there a fundamental spiritual piece here? And what about the environmental part? You talk about farming in a closed system where you're not bringing in a whole lot of stuff from all over the place. You're not using a whole lot of plastic and the rest. How important is that to you?
The closed system is hugely important to me. Both because financially it makes more sense and it makes the farm much more likely to be profitable in an economic sense, but also I want to pull away from this kind of mass market culture, and I want to be more connected to my land. The worst thing you can do to me is to come to the farm for a visit in the summer and bring bottled water and leave these plastic containers for me. I don't want them there. There's no need for them. I try to have no plastic, no garbage at my farm. It's a different culture, and it's not one that I want. I want to be connected to the land, and certainly in a spiritual way. I want a real connection to the food and to the land, and a slower sense of time, I think. You know, when we talk about a 50-year plan or how long it takes to raise a cow or how long it takes to make cheese or so, it's not this incredibly fast-paced life that we kind of now have in the cities. And I want to return to something that's much more organic, much more about the earth and about kind of a more spiritual thing. I'll go for that.
There's a lot of muddy boots, Tom, here, a lot of sweaty work. But you also you write about your Jersey cows and taking care of them as a kind of practice. It's almost like a Zen practice. Of course, in dairy it has to be. But it's just a commitment to that rhythm and focus of interaction and work there just with your cows, Kurt.
Oh, absolutely. They have to be milked twice a day, there's no question. They're milked at essentially the same time. It's a very, very similar process it's not even similar. It's the exact process every single day. They're in the line. They're always in the same lineup. They're milked the same way. And it gives you a chance to very much concentrate on what's going on and really be a part of that process, opposed to just, you know, running through it, you know, on your laptop or something.
Rebecca, I heard you there. Sorry.
Yes. Oh, I was just trying to break in because what I was hearing from Kurt was just so much what I've heard from so many other homesteaders I've interviewed over the years. And that language of getting back to the land, or well, that phrase is overused and connected with the 60s, but the language of being on the land, down to earth, I've heard that very much in the homesteaders I interviewed. And the notion of everyday things as being a kind of spiritual practice. I've talked to people who've literally said, milking cows is my spiritual practice. Some people say prayers. Some people meditate. I milk my cows. So I think Kurt is right on it, you know, from his own experience. And I can connect it to in mine. I have 5 sheep in a garden, and I'm not a homesteader. But that's a lot of my spiritual practice. And one thing I wanted to bring back all the way to a caller you had, Jake, who's mm-hmm. desperately wanting to get on his own land, and yep. several other people were talking about saving up for the time to be on their own land. And in terms of slowing down, I would say it's not only important to have a 10, 40, 50-year plan, but also what can you do where you are? And I remember talking to Helen Nearing, the sort of famous, sometimes infamous homesteader, and I said, you know, what should I do? I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you know, but I want to be more doing something homesteadish. And she said, plant the seeds you have and see what happens. And she knew she was speaking metaphorically as well as as practically. And I think for those who are in cities, there's a huge urban homesteading movement now that, again, wasn't there when I was writing my book. Huge. And I think there's a great desire to have CSAs and urban homesteading happening. And you don't have to have the I need to own my own plot of land kind of vision to make that happen. In fact, you can connect with people and work together in communities instead of each person trying to get their own farm. So I think that's another way to do it.
Plant the seed you have. Let me get another caller, too, if I may. Owensboro, Kentucky. Jesse's calling. Hi, Jesse. Thanks for calling, Jesse. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask Kurt what he thinks about the small farm movement. And, you know, I'm working and living, and my family runs a commercial-sized farm
yep.
Here in Kentucky, growing corn, soybeans, still a little bit of tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect the small farm movement. I think most commercial farmers do. We're proud of you guys out there with your 10 and 13 acres and 20 acres. But quite often I hear from small farms, they're bashing commercial-sized farms to get a foot up in the market, saying that, you know, that they're pro-organic, and I don't have a problem with organic, but, you know, why does it have to be that commercial farms are bad and small farms are good? We're producing food. We're making a difference in America and the world. We're still feeding the world. And I just wanted to get Kurt's comments on that, and I'll take my comments up here.
Jesse, I so appreciate your call. What do you say, Kurt? Jesse's out there. You know the kind of work he's doing, and he's sweating and bringing in that harvest and feels a little dissed maybe by the small farm movement, you know, looking for its leg up, looking for its way.
I think it's a fabulous question, first of all, and I wish I got it more. It's sadly a rare question. First of all, I would never bash the large farms. I could never produce, you know, millions of pounds of soybeans on my 13 acres, or wheat or corn or anything. Couldn't possibly. And I want to go out and have tortillas with my Mexican food tonight. I want some corn. It's incredibly necessary. I believe that those size farms produce something like 85%, 90% of all the food grown in America. I'm not trying to compete with those at all. I make a small amount of very boutique cheese for, you know, a few people in Seattle. And I think they're just completely separate businesses. They're very necessary. I wish they had, you know, some different practices. I think some of them could be questioned. I think some of my practices could be questioned without a doubt. And I think we all need to kind of, you know, constantly look at how we're growing food, what's the best way to grow it, and so on. But I'm certainly a voice against many of the people that I deal with of big is not bad and small is not good. There are some incredibly poor quality small farms. There's some incredibly high-quality large farms. I think it's about the quality of the food and the quality of the practices of growing that food, not the size of the acreage and so on.
Mid-sized Jesse, there's a little respect there from small farmer Kurt outside Seattle. Hey, Kurt, tell us about your next cheese. You've got your Dinah's. I got it right here on the table. It's delicious, right? Kind of Camembert. You've got a hard one. You've got a cheese cave you've just dug. We just got half a minute. What are you up to there?
I dug an underground cheese cave. It's pretty small, 350 square feet, barrel vaulted, solid concrete, incredibly reinforced. It's well underground underneath the pastures, and it'll hold about 900 of these Francesca's cheese.
That's a hard cheese.
12-month aged, hopefully raw milk. I'm not sure just yet. At least 12 months aged, maybe 14 months, kind of like a Grana Padino. And we're just starting testing it and trialing it, and it might take a little while. It might be a couple of years before it's in the marketplace, but I think it's going to be really a fabulous cheese.
Are you in it for life at this point, Kurt, or are you going to wander back to a condo downtown one day and leave it all behind?
Boy, that's a tough one. I would say a combination. I love the city. It's important to me. But my farm is great. It's where I live.
Well, you tell the story very well of getting in and what it takes, the work and the joys, and we really, it's been great to have you. Rebecca Gould, I want to thank you first at Middlebury College Studios in Vermont. Thank you so much for being with us today, Rebecca.
Thank you, Tom. It was a great discussion.
Rebecca Gould, author of At Home in Nature, and Kurt Timmermeister. His book is Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land. Kurt, good luck, and thank you so much for being with us.
Tom, thank you. It was my great pleasure.
We'll go out with the Vogues singing The Land of Milk and Honey. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.